It's a great pleasure to introduce Professor Azra Raza from Columbia University. She's taken on one of the toughest diseases. This is a real bane to our existence in the clinic, and that's myelodysplastic syndrome, because you can have patients that look fine, and then unfortunately some progress very, very quickly. So it shows that our current clinical markers of progression are not adequate. So Azra will talk about Armed with Genomics is the target in sight for myelodysplastic syndromes. She's the leader in MDS right now, so we're very fortunate to have her here. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for that very kind introduction, Katrina. Thank you to Ida. Thank you for Dr. Kipps for giving me this opportunity to come and address you. Early this morning, I happened to read an article written by a friend of mine, Morgan Meese, who was covering the Gaul Literary Festival in Sri Lanka. And there he hosted Professor Richard Dawkins, whose fame of the God delusion. At the end of his talk, somebody asked Dr. Dawkins a question. And the question was, why are all works of art inspired by religion and nothing by science? That made me think about my own experience with science, with which I have been obsessed since the ripe old age of 4 years. Some of us are constitutionally obsessed. Nobody has drafted us to do this. We are here because we cannot be anywhere else. In fact, that's the advice I give my 17-year-old daughter, that you should choose your career the way you choose a mate. Never marry someone you can live with. Only marry someone you can't live without. It's that sort of obsession that is needed. And when we as scientists discover a new intracellular signaling pathway or a new genetic mutation, we don't have to paint it. We don't have to sculpt it. What we want to do is look at the downstream events, what is happening, go further into the question. And for us, those of us who also take care of patients, the ultimate is how do we translate this into improved therapies. So, by the way, I wrote an 800-word answer to this question early this morning before coming here, and if you're interested later, I can direct you to the link about why only religion seems to be inspiring works of art. I feel personally, before I start my talk, that in order to translate our biologic insights, which we make in the laboratory, into improved therapies, we not only need close cooperation with industry, but we also need a complete overhaul of the clinical trial system in this country as well. It has become so draconian now to do anything for clinicians and so cumbersome and time-consuming that unless people who are directly involved in these studies really take a lead and demand that things have to become better, we are going to be throwing out lots of babies with the bathwater. What I'd like to do today is first learn how to use this. Okay. Just wanted to begin with a dramatic slide, which I find very, very dramatic. In terms of the Human Genome Project, which was completed in the year 2000, the next generation high-throughput sequencing can finish an entire human genome in 1 week. But Oxford Nanopore announced that by February 2013, a portable cartridge that doubles as a USB drive can be plugged into a computer to sequence the genome on the spot for less than $1,000 in under 1 hour. It's now possible to sequence multiple patients' normal and tumor genomes, and within a given cancer patient, we have this unique ability to compare the genome that they were born with the genome that develops in their cancer cells. We, for example, save T cells as well as buccal mucosa along with the tumor cells of the patient. I have been studying a disease called myelodysplastic syndromes, or MDS, which some of my patients say stands for My Disease Stinks. But it's a group of malignant hematopoietic disorders that present in an elderly group of patients. and they present with low blood counts. A third of the patients can progress to acute myeloid leukemia. So a typical patient would be an elderly patient who's presenting with anemia, may have low white count and platelet count, but the dramatic thing is that the bone marrow is cellular and dysplastic. And this is the paradox of low blood counts despite a generally cellular marrow that first caught my attention when I was 28 years old at Roswell Park Cancer Institute and completing my fellowship. And I proceeded to study these patients by giving them intravenous infusions of the thymidine analogs, BRDU and IUDR, directly to the patient and doing detailed cell cycle kinetics, and showed that, in fact, there are more cells synthesizing DNA and cycling faster in MDS marrows than in AML or normal marrows. In other words, this is not a disease of bone marrow failure. If anything, it's excessive proliferation. So the paradox was explained when we showed that two-thirds of MDS patients have evidence of excessive apoptosis, and a third could have as many as half their cells just undergoing apoptosis at any given time. This is mediated mainly by pro-inflammatory cytokines, and TNF is the master switch that turns the cascade on and off, which then led us to try anti-TNF therapies, and the first one available was thalidomide because it is an anti-TNF agent. And when we used that, we saw that 20% patients treated with thalidomide as a single agent became completely transfusion independent. Of course, since then, the analog lenalidomide has been developed, which is more potent and less toxic than thalidomide, and it is now approved for use in patients with deletion 5q. So this is the pivotal study that was done in deletion 5q patients, reported by Dr. Alan List, which showed that in 148 patients, the response was more than 75%, with 67% becoming completely transfusion independent. Half the responders also had a cytogenetic response, and 50% responded within practically a month. At the same time, I reported on a trial of the same drug, multicenter study, in non-deletion 5q patients. Of 214 such patients, overall response was 43%, with 26% acquiring complete transfusion independence. So the response to lenalidomide can be summarized as 70% patients respond who have deletion 5q, 26% respond without deletion 5q. Wouldn't it be great to be able to identify these responding patients? Because if patients have deletion 5q, sure, go ahead and give them lenalidomide. But what about this group where only a small percentage without deletion 5q is responding? And that's where we started collaborating with a team of Dr. Ebert and Todd Golub, who's the brilliant director of the cancer program at the Broad Institute of MIT. And Ben Ebert at the time was a fellow when we began to collaborate, has since blossomed into one of the brightest scientists. Dr. Galili is my scientific counterpart and director of the laboratory of MDS at Columbia University. And what we did is we started asking the question at the bedside. And we simply took patients who had responded to lenalidomide versus those who were resistant, irrespective of their karyotype. And what we saw was rather a dramatic difference between the two. These 50 genes were underexpressed by the responders. They turned out to be related to erythropoiesis. We have now converted this into a quantitative PCR, very rapid signature of 30 genes that can tell us who's going to respond. An expression profile is identified, which predicts clinical response to lenalidomide irrespective of karyotype. At Columbia, we have just two patients short of completing this prospective trial. Once confirmed, we are very excited that this test should be available to identify those non-deletion 5q patients who are going to respond. 5q minus syndrome is a specific subtype of MDS where patients present with this as a sole abnormality, female predominance. Patients have anemia with normal or increased platelet count. And this is the pathognomonic feature of the disease, higher platelet count than normal and anemia. Now, again, I want to point out the importance of collecting tissue. At Columbia, I see approximately 300 new MDS patients a year. A third of the patients evolve to AML. We are completely committed to therapy-driven research, and more than 90% of our patients in the MDS program are treated on clinical trials. And we have been collecting tissue for the last two-plus decades, so that we now have 50,000 samples on our patients. They're of all sorts. As I said, we collect T-cells, buccals, mucosa, etc. for control. We have all kinds of data. It's literally the ultimate in one-click efficiency. So you can name the most obscure cytogenetic abnormality, and we can find out hundreds of patients' samples that we have, along with clinical information. And using this repository, we again collaborated with Drs. Ebert and Golub, and this time looked at 5q- syndrome patients. So it's not just patients who have 5q- but who have the syndrome, which I just had described earlier to you. And it's known that the deletion on 5q only affects one allele. So whatever is missing is only reduced by 50%. We call that haploinsufficiency. Deletion is variable. It can be small or long, but one area is always deleted. That's the commonly deleted segment, which has 41 genes. And using RNA interference, one gene was silenced at a time to see what happens to the cell. And it was the knockdown of a single gene, RPS14, which caused apoptosis in erythroid cells, that is anemia, while preserving megakaryocytic differentiation, that means high platelet count. And this matched, recapitulated the clinical syndrome in vitro. Now, forced expression of this gene using cDNA into the primary six cells of patients with 5q- syndrome rescued the phenotype, which further proved that this is the gene that is causing 5q- syndrome. What is RPS14? It is a ribosome protein synthesis, gene 14. And, of course, this protein is responsible for the generation of 18S rRNA. And 50% reduction in gene expression causes rapidly dividing cells to undergo apoptosis, but slowly dividing cells accumulate the reduced dose of the gene and continue proliferation. So, in fact, deletion of the gene from both alleles wouldn't be giving rise to the syndrome. It has to be the haploinsufficiency. Interestingly, other ribosomal genes are abnormal in congenital anemia, such as Blackfan diamond, Shwachman diamond, etc. So recent studies have now shown that expression of multiple ribosomal genes are decreased in other MDS subtypes. So we began knowing nothing about ribosome proteins. Now we know defective ribogenesis may be a feature common to all types of MDS. So the molecular basis of excessive apoptosis has finally surfaced. P53 controls multiple pathways inducing apoptosis. Ribosome stress response refers to increased P53 expression as a direct result of defective ribogenesis, and mice lacking RPS14 gene through deletion of 5q show exactly this: elevation of P53, excessive apoptosis, and dysplastic morphology. The cytopenias in MDS may thus be the result of deregulated ribosomal biosynthesis leading to the ribosomal stress response, leading to activation of P53 and then excessive apoptosis. So an unexpected link between acquired 5q- syndrome and congenital marrow failure syndromes has been found. 5q- syndrome is RPS14. Congenital anemias have these ribosomal protein synthesis genes. And this is where my co-worker, my partner within MDS research at Columbia University comes in. This is Dr. Siddhartha Mukherjee. I'm very proud of him because he has just won the Pulitzer Prize this year for his really beautiful, beautifully written book, The Emperor of All Maladies. And somebody wrote a very nice article on both of us saying that Dr. Raza and Mukherjee have one thing in common: they both have good hair. So Bone, he published a lovely article in Nature that I think is shifting the paradigm about what we think about MDS. And what this article shows is the following. Mesenchymal cells of osteolineage regulate hematopoietic stem cells. Dicer 1 is an RNase 3 endonuclease essential for microRNA biogenesis and RNA processing. MicroRNAs regulate hematopoietic cell fate. So what they did is they deleted Dicer 1 from the osteolineage cells. Deleting this gene from stromal cells, they found that mice develop MDS. And this is the first demonstration and induction of a genetic defect in stromal cell resulted in a parenchymal disease. Dicer 1 deletion reduced the expression of Shwachman-Bodian-Diamond syndrome gene, the gene mutated in this syndrome. And now deletion of SBDS in osteoprogenitors induced MDS. So a beautiful link. In conclusion, then, stromal cell dysfunction can result in MDS. So I've been interested, for example, in a viral etiology of MDS. We've been looking using the parenchymal cells. Now we know that maybe we should be looking at stromal cells, and that's exactly what we've been doing now for the last couple of years, growing tons of stromal cells and saving them and studying them along with the parenchymal cells. All of us have been talking about seed and soil. Many of us have been talking about seed and soil, the contribution of the microenvironment to the cellular abnormalities, but talk is cheap. I think Sid Mukherjee has shown it for the first time. There are many benefits to sharing a lab and your work with a Pulitzer Prize winner, because now we can travel in private planes occasionally. When people fly him, I hang along with him. Now, there are three, I'm going to finish quickly now, I have just a couple of minutes. There are three FDA-approved drugs for MDS, hypomethylating drugs, azacitidine, decitabine, and lenalidomide for low-risk disease, but clearly we need additional therapies. Isatiostat is a glutathione S1 transferase inhibitor, and that is one drug we were very interested in. I did a clinical trial. I've reported in four separate papers, four separate clinical trials with this agent. It's very exciting. It does have a tri-lineage response in patients can occur with this drug. And we wanted to know that isatiostat is beneficial for a subset of low-risk patients, but can we identify another profile that would help us identify potential responders? So total RNA, so we just did expression profiling. I'm not going to go into details. And once again, we found that clearly patients who respond to this drug underexpress microRNA 129 and overexpress microRNA 155, and beautiful signatures. In addition, what we found was that the June kinase pathway genes are affected, and this is exactly how the drug is supposed to act. So, in fact, patients who are underexpressing the June kinase pathway are the ones who are going to respond. So, in conclusion, a bedside to bench strategy correlating genomic data with clinical response yielded positive markers. This genomic signature may enable future selection of patients. And then the third last one that we did is a combination of thalidomide and azacitidine or Vidaza. We enrolled 40 patients on this study, and we wanted to see, can we predict a response to Vidaza? And once again, we have a beautiful signature. And this time, these 50 genes are overexpressed in patients who are going to have resistant disease. And so overexpression of they turned out to be proliferation related. In other words, patients who have rapidly cycling cells and overexpress 22 of these proliferation related genes are not going to respond to Vidaza. And so Finally, we published a paper working again with Ben Ebert that came out in the June issue of New England Journal last year, where we have identified point mutations associated with clinical features. I'm sure you all know this work. I'm not going to go into details, but in summary, point mutations are common in MDS. Activating oncogene mutations are rarer, but mutations of five genes present in over 30% of samples are independent predictors of overall survival. These are the five genes. And finally, RNA splicing machinery abnormalities have recently been described. Once again, I'm not going to go into details, but it turns out that patients who have MDS with ring sideroblasts, almost 85% of them, can have mutations in this particular splicing gene, which is SF3B1. And it turns out that there is an improved survival associated with those patients who have SF3B1, turns out to have a better survival. So overall summary of my talk is that a bedside-to-bench approach of comparing responders versus non-responders using DNA microarrays yielded distinct signatures for 3 out of 3 drugs we tested. Furthermore, each signature identified pathways that were relevant for the mechanism of action of the drug. For lenalidomide, erythroid genes. For izatiostat, the June kinase pathway. And for Vidaza, the proliferation-related genes. So biology really seems to parallel the clinical features here, which is the best part. Oh, sorry. And then new data implicates stromal cells in MDS pathology. Genetic mutations associated with survival have been identified, and defects in splicing machinery have opened up a whole new area of research. So my last question, armed with genomics, is the end in sight? And to answer that, I'm just going to read you a short letter that my patient sent me. Miss Kitty is in her 60s, had a transfusion-dependent anemia with a hemoglobin in 8-gram range due to MDS. She started lenalidomide, and here is what she wrote after 6 months of treatment when her hemoglobin was 13 grams. Dear Dr. Raza, you asked me to try to put in writing some of what I described to you about how I've been feeling in response to Revlimid. I've been paying attention to my body as it responds to the new medication. As my hemoglobin ratchets up into the realms of the normal, I've been concentrating on the physical gains, being able once again to negotiate subway stairs, return to my daily walks around Fort Tryon Park, hills included, and in general to just keep up. I've observed all this carefully and have been so grateful. But the big surprise came when I noticed something that I hadn't realized I had lost, my head. I feel a sense of exhilaration as I find myself filled with ideas, making connections, feeling stimulated, and finding it so much easier to express what's on my mind. Nothing, mind you, brilliant or original, but still me. I'm thrilled with this discovery, doubly so because I hadn't realized how much I had lost until I gained it back. And I think one such letter makes up for all the heartaches that we go through in our careers. I thank you very much for your attention and show you a view from my office.